Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans will be in order. Today is Monday, January 24th, 2011. And I truly apologize for the five-minute delay. I told you early on that wouldn't happen. It's unfortunate, but I'm going to work my hardest to make sure that gavel drops at the top of the hour at 1 o'clock, so I apologize for that. I see a quorum is present. So I thought it was, to start this out, I thought it was appropriate for me to adjourn last week. Some thought, wow, that was abrupt. But being we were running over time and being that we had senators here that were requesting an opportunity to further examine the appointment that was before us last week, I thought it was best to give that time from last Wednesday through today. And I would hope that all of you have taken time to visit with the appointee and solve any issues that you might have with some knowledge background. Just to let you know, there were some questions about gubernatorial holdovers. The last time that this happened was back in 2003. Approximately 65 were held over from the Ventura to the Pawlenty gubernatorial. So, and there is a copy, by the way, of those 65 senators in your folder. Because of the special interest in the appointments within the jurisdiction of this committee that will be taken up this year, I know there's been some special interest in some of those. Finally, I hope that you were able to use that extra time, as I mentioned, to gather more information prior to the committee today. And I do want to thank all of you who contacted me for your thoughts after last week's meeting. I'm glad that we are all very interested and motivated to thoroughly examine action taken within this committee. At this time, do any of the members have any questions about the appointment procedures before we move into our first item on the agenda? Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, I'm the person who raised the questions about the holdover, and I don't remember, and I'm not disputing this because I was around in 2002-2003. I did get some information that was able to do some further work in the interim period, including looking at the limited case law. The information I got is, to be honest, is not dissimilar from what you received. Going back to 1970-71, the carryover from Levander to Anderson, where apparently it was a pretty major fight within the Senate. And there were some appointments, including a couple of commissioner appointments. And there was no real resolution. It appears that the resolution then was to have some kind of compromise where one commissioner was confirmed, one commissioner was not. The then Lieutenant Governor Rudy Perpich got into it. There's an article, mostly I have newspaper stories from reporters who certainly aren't around any longer. But apparently there was some significant concern then, and a resolution where some appointments were made, some appointments weren't. And I'm looking at one of the articles, Lieutenant Governor Perpich blasts appointment conflict. This was at a DFL fundraiser in Rochester. It also indicates that in addition to the Lieutenant Governor's speech, about an estimated 150 persons turned out for the dance here despite thick fog. So that was the other thing I picked up from this. That's how Rochester looked at it. So this has been helpful to get a sense of where we are legally. I apologize because I just don't recall concerns raised or the issue raised in 2002-2003. I wondered about the carryover from Perpich to Carlson. It doesn't appear anything happened then, but certainly 70-71 it did. So,
all right.
So thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to just publicly thank you for the opportunity to pause for just a bit. I had a great meeting with Judge Krause in my office. I enjoyed very much. Very comfortable supporting his confirmation going forward. It gave him an opportunity, I think, to touch base with the governor's office, which I think was good as well. And then we had a chance to review the case law, too. So I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Senator Wager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the confirmation of Judge Krause.
Senator Wigger moves that the committee recommend the confirmation of Raymond Kraus for Chief Administrative Law Judge, Office of Administrative Hearings. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Carried. All motion prevails, and Your Honor, we will send this to the floor. Thank you. Congratulations. Let's move on. The second item on the agenda is a presentation on innovation from Gopal Khanna. Many of you may remember that Mr. Khanna was appointed Minnesota's first Chief Information Officer by Governor Tim Pawlenty on August 15, 2005, and reappointed back in January 2nd, 2007. And I thought, being that we're challenged with innovation with this committee, to take a look at agencies and how we can better serve our citizens, that a great starting point would be Mr. Khanna. And I'm not sure if all of you have seen the Commission on Service Innovation report. If not, we definitely could get you a copy of that. But it's in your packet, by the way. I'm excited about this because I truly believe that through innovation with technology and IT, that we truly can serve our citizens better. So with that, would you please state your name, and let's move forward.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Gopal Khanna. I'm currently a senior fellow at the Technological Leadership Institute at the University of Minnesota. Previously had the pleasure and honor of serving as chair of the Commission on Service Innovation last year. Thank you for inviting me to speak on behalf of the Commission's work. I have in your, hopefully you have in your handout, two things. One, a PowerPoint presentation. We had some technical difficulties, so we don't have it up here for you. However, it should be, so we'll walk through that PowerPoint presentation, as well as the Commission's report. I would, over the next few minutes, go over our findings and share with you the exciting opportunities before the state. I had, as I mentioned, I had the great honor and privilege of serving as the chair of this commission, which was established last year as a result of bipartisan legislation put forth by Senator Terry Bonoff and Representative Keith Downey, and was signed by Governor Pawlenty, and commenced the work in July. Over the next 6 months, the commission met, and we had a very clear charter and mission as was put forth by the statute. It was to really look at ways to re-engineer and the delivery of state and local government services to the citizens and make it better. With that vision in mind, very well-defined vision, we set about working, and I would ask you to move on to slide which talks about the membership. It was one of the finest memberships that I personally have had a chance to work with. It was extremely broad-based. We had representation from the business community, the Chamber of the Chamber, Business Partnership, MHTA were represented, nonprofits were represented as well, the Bush Foundation, Citizens League, Nonprofits Council, the Wilder Foundation, local governments were represented as well, League of Minnesota Cities, Townships, as well as education, both MinSCU and University of Minnesota. And several government employee unions were represented as well. Actually, there were four members from three unions, AFSCME, MAPE, SEIU. And in my capacity as the state CIO, I too was one of the 19 members. The nutshell was the commission's composition was extremely diverse. It was a combination of public-private viewpoints. It was a group that was really balanced from bringing perspectives from all angles that one can ask for. The membership was extremely knowledgeable and involved and engaged. They were very creative. They were looking at both operational opportunities as well as what the long-term possibilities were as well. And most important of all, they were very focused on outcomes and saying how can the outcomes in terms of delivery of government services can be better and very future-oriented. So what you had Mr. Chairman and members, a very diverse and broad-based group of people looking into government from outside in. An extremely extremely wonderful vantage point, which I think so as you'll find and you go through the findings and recommendations that it brings out a very very good business perspective, business from the point of view of running the operations well, effectively, and efficiently, and making them citizen-centric. Over the last 6 months, what the group did was basically we broke down into 5-6 different groups and looked at different areas so that we could come back and report to you and bring to the legislature a holistic view rather than a one-sided or a one-dimensional view. And what we had was we defined the problems, we looked at the problems, we talked about it, we looked at what the compelling requirements and needs were to do things differently. We looked at and we envisioned what the state of government operations needs to be in the future, as well as we looked at how shared services can be leveraged. What we found out was there was a lot of good work happening in various units of government all across our state, and there were opportunities to leverage the shared services. We had a group that looked at that. We had a group that focused on workforce and culture issues as well. What we realized was there's a huge people component to the workings of government, and we did not want to overlook that. There is certainly a workforce component as well as the culture of innovation itself. There's been much talk about innovation these days, but innovation cannot happen without very active engagement of the workforce entirely up and down the management chain. We looked at the government processes and governance structures that could be potentially put in place, as well as, most important of all, given the fact and the reality that we live in digital age, how we can get the citizens engaged as co-producers involved with the government, and not only provide open government transparency and availability, but also engage them in their government. What we found was that basically at the end of the day, and then you've heard a lot from the state economist and demographer, that however we look at it, the bottom line is even with the recession coming to an end and as the economy ramps up, it really is going to be a different paradigm when it comes to the economics of the state government, and that for years to come, the economic realities are going to be difficult and hard to manage the imbalance between the revenue as well as the obligations to the public. What we found was that also, which you all know about, is that the demographic shifts are also going to create enormous amount of pressures on the functioning and the operations of the government, both from the workforce perspective as well as the people that we serve. We, in nutshell, basically surmised what we all know and have heard publicly, that even though even if the revenues were to grow, and if you look at the growth of our spending for K-12 as well as healthcare, really in 25 years, we will not have any funds left for any other programs at the state level. So given all these economic realities, what did we find? We found that we need to really take a step back and rethink in terms of the architecture and design of the government operations completely. And basically, if you look at our 10 recommendations, they focus in 4 or 5 key areas. One is we believe that we can take advantage of the shared services platforms that are already in existence and then proliferating both in the executive branch as well as counties and cities are trying with the same approach to reduce their cost structure to take advantage and scale up the deployment of the shared services at the state. The second thing we found was that we need to really rethink how we budget for in government. The quintessential old approach of having the base budget and then tinkering around it for different services will not cut. We really have to take a different paradigm and look at budgeting for outcomes. It's a bold, different way of looking at government, and we need to do that. We also found out that we need to look at the efficacy of creating charter agencies or performance-based organizations, a new way of the legislature working with entities that could provide services more on outcomes-based and performance measures as opposed to just being an existing status quo organization the way it is structured right now. If you look at our recommendations, we talk about our lean program. Over the last couple of years, state of Minnesota, the executive branch has experimented with and adopted lean practices thanks to General Mills. And one of the members from General Mills was also a member of the commission and co-chaired the commission. They have done a good job in bringing that knowledge to state government. And over the last 2 years, the executive branch has used the lean technologies, lean methods successfully. There's a unique opportunity to broaden that program to include business process reengineering and the technologies that are available, and not only scale it, but make it available to all units of government. It should not be just restricted to the executive branch. It should be made available to counties, cities, and all units of government. Because ultimately what we found was to change the culture from the current culture of operation to a culture that is innovation-centric in terms of people in the workforce, we need to bring the same practices all across the units of government. We also talked about creating a quasi-government entity such as a public corporation to provide innovation incentives. We talk about innovation, but innovation requires requires that we not penalize risk-taking. There's got to be a way to de-risk the initiatives, but we have to allow for incentives so people can take part and be innovative and be incentive. What we felt was that right now there were not enough available in terms of tools in all units of government where people had the incentive to be innovative. There's a need for us to look at what kind of innovation tools can be created by encouraging people to be and give them the incentives to be innovative. We also found that it would be essential to have some kind of a innovation fund created. It could be in the form of grants or as well as in terms of investments where there's a return expectation on the part of this investment fund that is created to encourage, again, providing the seed capital so that innovative activities can be launched in state and local government. We also found there's a need to unlock the data and the information. We live in an information age, and we in government collect enormous amount of data, but that raw data is not yet converted into meaningful information for both internal decision-making purposes as well as making it available for active participation on the part of the citizens as well and our stakeholders in government. So in nutshell, those were our recommendations. As you look at these recommendations, do not please look for a silver bullet solution because there is none over there. What we have done in terms of the commission's work is to make this body of work available to you based upon what we heard in terms of the people that came and participated and provided insights as well as our own workings so that you can take this as a base platform of ideas and take them to the next level in terms of both conversation, context, and finding a way to working with the executive branch to see how they can be operationalized going forward. If you look at the outcome from an outcomes perspective, what will happen? Yes, we do recognize, we did recognize in the commission that the budgetary imbalance that you have before us is rather large and substantial. It cannot be solved by the work that the commission has done on its own. However, there are opportunities to effect cost savings because the focus will be on removing and eliminating redundancies and duplication. And because of the fact that the government structure has evolved over the last 50 years in a very siloed way, and we all talk about our vertical silos, there are therefore embedded in that whole structure a lot of redundancies and duplications. By eliminating them, there exists in the short term an opportunity to really effect some substantial budgetary savings. The commission felt that even if there was 1% savings through all of these programs and initiatives, that would amount to about $250 million in annual savings for state and local governments. We believe that in the long run, there will be not only cost of a reduction in cost of deployment of services, but also improvement. And most important of all, we'll be creating an innovative environment, a workplace in government as well, which is needed on an ongoing basis. Innovation cannot be something that is done one time, but it needs to be put in place in terms of the incentives and ways of doing business so that it is continual and the enterprise is continually inventing itself to be in sync with the realities 5 years from now, 15 years from now, and 50 years from now. Will the government employees be impacted? In the short term, we believe that both in the short and long term, we in the commission felt that there was a need for both the labor and the management to work as partners, because innovation cannot happen without that strong partnership and trust and honesty. We also believe that while immediate layoffs would not happen, the commission's work and focus on innovation will help improve the work processes, so as the workforce retires over the next 10 years with the aging of the government workforce, there's a unique opportunity that we can deliver services with fewer people and make the environment more efficient. We do recognize that there's an aging of the workforce happening as well. So we believe that these recommendations can help align service delivery with the wave of retirements that will be coming up in state and local governments as well, with the baby boomers leaving and retiring. The next steps, we believe that if in commission is that and would encourage the legislature to have conversation on the findings. We have already done a lot of work right from the inception in making our work available to the public for public comment. Everything was done within the context of and within the purview of the open meeting laws. Our work was streamlined online, was available for comments. So this document that you're seeing has been made available to the public at large. And we hope that you would be able to take this work and then take it to the next level by finding ways of exploring approaches that can help operationalize the recommendations that have been put forth. We have LCC is hosting our website. The material is available online. And I shall now open the floor for questions.
Well, Mr. Khan, thank you very much there. But I want to take it one step. You can see what I'm doing to you right now. I want to take it one step because where I get excited about the technology and where I just want to bring it down to the simplest terms, I want you to take that flip chart, which you love to draw on, if you would. Would you, and committee, I bring this up because we know we have 130, 140 agencies in the state, and would you just give us a simplified view of how we could, you know, because we have all this data that appears to be unusable at this point because we have so many silos. And as we move forward to bring our agencies together, can you just give us a quick snapshot of that base and why it's so important as we take a look at the different things in each agency, from IT to HR and all that, and how you would see that come together?
Mr. Chairman, I'll try.
Okay.
So let me take off my hat of being the former chair of the Commission on Service Innovation, and let me put on my hat as in my capacity as a private citizen and as somebody who's worked in government as well as in the private sector. Fundamentally speaking, here's what I see. I hope you can hear me.
If you can't hear him, I can have him grab hold of the microphone and hold it at the same time.
Government structure has grown as our programs were put in place by Congress and state legislatures. And basically, the structure of our government looks like what we call these could be education department, transportation, services, and on. So as our programs grew from the 30s and the 40s into the 60s and 70s, basically government structures grew like this. It was a perfect structure at that time. It was designed and fashioned around the corporate model and very much process-centric.
Could you set one of the mics kind of on the corner, I think, so that it'll pick up the mic, one of the microphones.
Right.
So that you pick up for the tape.
So the structure that you see today was pretty much a construct of the 50s and the 60s. It was our government structures operationally were designed by the likes of Deming, Durand, Peter Drucker, and then in the 60s by the best and the brightest. Politics aside, the best and the brightest brought management techniques to government, and as the government was growing under Kennedy administration and Lyndon Johnson administration, what they did was they replicated the corporate model. The citizens loved to be served during the hours of 9 to 5. America was on wheels. We drove to our banks, insurance companies, and government, and it was a 9 to 5 relationship with the customers, the citizen. Also, as these programs were constructed, they were very program-centric. The challenge we had in the era before that was there was a lot of corruption, fraud, waste, and abuse in the system. The political system, people found a lot of abnormalities in terms of seepage. So the construct of bureaucracy was to make sure that was curbed. The bureaucracy has been exceedingly successful over the last 50 years. They have accomplished the mission of being able to make sure that the government is clean, open, transparent, and operates with all the audits and controls. However, when this construction happened, what we have is we have redundancies that are built in processes in our organizational structure. And that happens over a period of time. It happens in corporate America as well. As a matter of fact, Cargill Corporation is one corporation. However, there are 79 companies in Cargill Corporation, and they all have their own back offices, their own ERP solutions, their own procurement. And right now, as we speak, they're going to be spending $1 billion to modernize and put their ERP solution in place, which, by the way, in state, our legislature approved 2 years ago, and we call that the SWIFT project, which is going to be taking more of a horizontal view of accounting and financial management as well. So it is utterly important that organizations become citizens. To become citizen-centric, we have got to realize that we have to operate in a 24/7 environment. Citizens are not content with being served during the hours of 9 to 5. Our children, my daughter, she's a banker, and she works out of her home, and right now she's in New York City, and she's working from there while her office is down in downtown Minneapolis. Her clients are all over the world, and she's able to work anywhere and everywhere. She supports, and she's on a rotational basis. So our government has to be structured to recognize the reality that our citizens want to be engaged. They want open data, information, and transparency. Our data is locked in all over. We knew about the 19 bad guys, but we could not connect the dots and know and stop the event from happening because we could not see the information horizontally. Likewise, today, we in government know about our citizen services. We know about, we have raw data, but it is spread all over and cannot be harmonized. It needs to be harmonized and leveraged to understand our customers. There are a handful of American companies who do a marvelous job. Amazon.com, eBay, Google, they all rely on data and they convert that into valuable information and serve their customers. Likewise, we too have to do that. So how do we go about doing it? We need to move from this architecture of government design to one that is more flat organizational structure. What we need is shared services model, which basically takes all the back office operational pieces that are common to all. Because when we look at our programs, we always talk about how unique they are. Yes, indeed, they are unique. Correction is unique when compared to human services. Human services is unique compared to transportation. But the unique component is much smaller when you see it in the context of shared services, which is the back office platform. Then above that is your data and information. Data and information of the citizen. Literally, we have. Today, a citizen gets served from birth certificate to death certificate. And a citizen doesn't care when Katrina happens, whether FEMA failed, the mayor failed, or the governor failed, or the executive branch, or the city branch failed. They say government failed, and they lose trust in government. And that happens because while they expect the service from end to end, they don't get it. We have to manage our assets in government, digital assets, data assets of the citizens, and be sure that it is secure, harmonized data that we use to convert into knowledge about our programs, the outcomes. Are the programs being effective. We do not know that today because we really cannot measure and look at our data holistically. What we also need, therefore, is an easy access, secure, easy access. Now, state of Minnesota, a couple of years ago, thanks to the legislature and thanks to the governor's vision, has put in place an e-licensing program which creates that platform where citizens can access easily. Over the next 2-3 years, as this gets implemented, that platform will help. A lot of work has already been put in place in Minnesota to build the shared services program. I gave you the example of the SWIFT project, the consolidation of data centers. All these activities will move towards more of a shared platform that can be used by agencies. And then what you need, of course, is the subject matter expertise of agencies to be able to provide the know-how, the knowledge, and understand the outcomes of the programs and manage them effectively. And that will happen as this data gets unlocked and gets used for really from an information perspective. So a lot of work needs to be done for us to migrate from here to here. What you have going right now, what the commission, and I'll put on my commission hat once again, commission recognized that there is a lot of work already happening in the area of shared services that can be leveraged and enhanced and scaled up. We also recognize that we need to do a lot more work in terms of making the data available to make government not only transparent and accountable, but also to get our citizens engaged as co-producers. Right now, our customers in their private lives participate in their service delivery, whether it be bank, insurance company, or any entity they do business with. They are co-producers. They are in a self-serve mode. The same citizen, when they deal with their government, should not be changing their approach. And as a matter of fact, as more and more intelligent handheld devices are made available to us, to our citizens, they would expect the government to be able to, they would expect that they should be able to do business with the government through this handheld device, because that is their modus operandi on a day-to-day basis. So having said that, what is needed is a complete re-architecting of the government operations model. I believe it is very possible today because of the tools and technologies that are available and the kind of stuff that is already happening in Minnesota, where the opportunities to scale it, whether it be lean processing to move towards business process and restructure and make sure that as the workforce ages, that we don't replace one for one, that we take advantage and make our processes more efficient and effective. Hopefully that gives you a visual picture.
All right, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Khanna. We have about 7 minutes for questions. Anyone have any questions of Mr. Khanna on this? Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. It's very thought-provoking. My question is about that last comment that you made. If you would just follow up a little bit. I think we have been labor-driven in government, and now we should be switching to a more information-driven model. And I'm wondering, you know, where do you believe we should begin with that? How do we downsize, aside from the legal requirements that we have for negotiations, but how do we do that? Do we move people into that shared services first, identify them, or do we identify the specialties first? Do you have any suggestions for us about how do we transition from the one model to the next?
Mr. Khanna.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, members, this transition is not going to happen one step at a time. I think so. It'll require activities in multiple areas at the same time. So it's not really a matter of moving away from a labor or a human capital centric workflow to more data and information centric workflow. Actually, the transition will be the same as Thomson West is going through right now, Cargill Corporation is going through, and we too have to go through, and US Bank has gone through, and so has Wells Fargo Bank. So if you look at our activities, what we'll have to realize is that there are a lot more technologies available to manage the data as opposed to managing it manually. So those functions would have to move towards shared services platform. Shared services platforms are not 100% automated. They would require human capital as well. So what will happen is that human capital will get directed into different areas. So as you look at this model, they will be supporting the activities in that. So even if you look at the workings of Amazon.com, which is a very data-centric organization, there is workforce that supports it. So the same kind of transition will happen to our workforce as well. what will happen is that they'll move more towards using the tools and technologies and the best practices. So what we're doing is we are really enabling our workforce to become more productive. At the end of the day, it's about productivity gains. And one of the things that the commission also talks about and is in the document is that innovation will come from productivity gains, and those productivity gains will get unlocked when innovation happens. So it feeds each other.
Thank you.
I was just mentioning to Lucas here that some of you are missing nameplates, and it was not intended that way, but I just noticed that, and we'll make sure that the nameplates are in the front. Yes, Senator Dibble, yours is there.
Okay.
Senator Torres, right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. this is such a fascinating presentation. I really appreciate that you invited the guests to present. Mr. Khanna, I have a question with respect to resources. Do you believe that we have the capacity to transform from one system to the other using current resources and capacity? You mentioned at the beginning of the presentation that, you know, to transform, that agencies are making right now significant investments to move from one place to the other. Cargill is investing $1 billion to do this. So one, you probably know very well we don't have $1 billion to invest in the transformation. But is it your opinion after the review that we have the capability and the foundation perhaps and the internal capacity to transform because we have to do this, I believe. I think that you're talking about really something that everybody's talking about. You know, government really needs to take these steps. But how do we do it with the existing resources and the existing capacity that we have? Can we do this transformation without having to input, you know, $1 billion today?
Mr. Khanna.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, members, there are many ways to go about making the transition. One is to take the approach of saying, let's build the best ballpark, and then we shall all arrive and play in that best ballpark. That will require just a phenomenal amount of investments. We don't have the money, and no corporation does it that way. What would have to be done is we'll have to start unlocking the current barriers. We do have in the current system a lot of barriers because the way the program-centric approach, what the program-centric approach has done in government is that it has created funding that is totally isolated on a siloed basis. So when it comes to technology, the architecture has to be horizontal. And this is something that even happens in the federal grants that come to us in look at MMIS system, which is a major healthcare system. Federal government will fund 90% for renovation of those systems. Each of these systems throughout the country will cost about $150-200 million per state. But their rules are such that they prohibit creating the architecture design so that the other programs can benefit from it. And that was designed, those rules were designed to make sure that there was no foul play and misuse of the funds. But that was an old rule that was applicable 30, 40 years ago. Today, it comes in the way of building an architecture that should be used as a government platform. So what has to be done is there are a lot of barriers that we'll have to think about. Can they be unlocked? Can there be a more horizontal view of government? Can the funding be used so that multiple programs benefit from the architectural design of the system? So yes, by unlocking that, we can find enough internal resources to redirect them. So the first approach would be to find ways to remove the barriers, whether it be human capital barriers or workforce-related barriers to investment barriers, and take advantage of funding that can be supporting multiple programs and multiple units of government. So we'll have to take a more of a horizontal view that will require unlocking the current barriers and taking out the things that slow down the system today, in whether it be procurement, whether it be budgeting and accounting systems, whether it be HR systems. And in the commission's report, we talk about becoming more outcomes-based in terms of our approach, and these supporting structures would have to be re-looked at. So to answer your question, will investments be needed? Yes, they'll be needed. Are there internal resources available? Yes, if we unlock those utilization of those resources and make them available horizontally, yes, there are. Is there a talent pool? Yes, I think government workforce is very knowledgeable and can do a lot of good work. I think so. We also have our own private sector companies here in town who are eager to help. I think there are resources available that can be leveraged in the marketplace to be able to help us with the transition. So it is absolutely possible. I think what we have to do is we have to unlock the ingenuity of the American workforce and American public in the government setting, which we have not done. We see enormous amount of innovation happening by the very same people in the private sector. Why not in government as well? We have to unlock those.
All right. Thank you. Senator Daley.
Thank you very much for a great presentation. I'm anxious to get started. As I look at these recommendations, we may sit around and think a lot of great thoughts and have lots of great ideas, but unless we implement things, no change is going to happen. So as you look at these recommendations, have we begun any pilot projects? Have we taken any tangible actions to follow up with these things yet? That's the first question.
Mr. Khanna.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, members, I can report on the activities while I was still in government. I've since left, and there are a lot of activities that are already taking place. When it comes to shared services, there are a lot of activities in place already in state government, where there is a shared services platform that is either in place or is getting built out. I gave you the example of our SWIFT project that's going to be, I believe, going into production July 1. There is consolidation of data centers happening. So there's an opportunity to scale some of those activities in a very big way. You're right, sir. Will there be new activities required as a result of this recommendation in terms of legislature looking and working with the administration? Yes, that as well. So there is activity, but there's a lot can be done to create the incentives, to give the encouragement to do more work is what is needed.
Senator Daley.
You touched on my other question. That is, as you look through this list of recommendations, were you to prioritize them, do you have a top one or two or three that we should focus on first?
Mr. Khanna.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, members, if I personally look at them, I would say that I would encourage the legislature and the administration to take a more of a holistic approach. There might be some ideas which you can act upon now. So what will come out is, and I'll draw your attention to the presentation given by Larry Keeley from Dublin on the 12th of January at the day-long retreat the legislature had, where I had the honor and privilege of presenting as well. And I'm working with Larry Keeley closely to bring him back to Minnesota so that we can come up with a program for innovation in government, which is designed for government particularly. And the theme that Larry Keeley was presenting is that we need to have a few initiatives that can bring short-term results and create an environment that, yes, this is something right thing to do, but at the same time, have a couple of bold ideas as well that we work on that may take a couple of years to do and complete, but they will totally be transformative. So, and I come from the same school of thought. I would say is that we've got to take the bold approach. We just cannot be taking a minimalist approach. If we were running a company, we would be running scared because our competition will take us out of business. And we will not be taking a minimalist approach. We'll have to take a bold approach. Will there be mistakes? Yes. And as Larry Keeley was pointing out, we've got to find a way to de-risk them by having strong portfolio management, project management, making sure that there's oversight, governance. But we cannot be so scared to take action that there is no action. And the part of the problem in government in terms of from a culture point of view is that it is designed so that there's no risk taking. And transformation cannot happen without risk taking.
All right,
it's counterintuitive.
Thank you very much. We're going to move on, but I do want to tell the members that Mr. Connor will be on Wednesday, the 26th, 8:15 a.m., room 200 of the State Office Building.
On that agenda will be another panel discussion on innovation and transformation opportunities in government, which is a follow-up discussion on this 2010 Minnesota Commission on Service Innovation report that you're all welcome to attend. Mr. Khanna, thank you very much, and we look forward to keeping you in the loop here and helping us as we move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
The final item on the agenda is a presentation on innovation by Mr. Tony Murphy, who is the Beltrami County Administrator. And you talk about putting some of these practices into effect. I was happy to hear from Senator Carlson, who brought Mr. Murphy to my attention, of some of the exciting things over the last couple of years that have been happening in Beltrami County. So welcome to the committee, and please state your name, and we'll move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tony Murphy. I'm the Beltrami County Administrator, county seat in Bemidji. I'm grateful to be here with you today and to share a few thoughts about the journey that we've been going through in Beltrami County for the last 4 years as we've been attempting to, I guess for lack of a better word, to reinvent how we do county business. I'm pleased that our county board chair, Commissioner Giovanni, is here with me, and I'm grateful for the support that we've had from our elected officials as we've gone through this process. And so I have a four-page handout that you should have received. I don't have time today to go through all those points, so what I would like to do, though, is to hit on a few of the highlights and kind of walk through that journey a little bit in hopes that we would have some time at the end for some questions or to provide even a few more solid examples of some of the things we've been doing. I think the best place for me to start, I appreciated the presentation that came before me. I couldn't help but listen to what was being said and immediately apply it to my circumstance as a county official. Much of what was being spoken of there was identifying and speaking to state structures and state opportunities for innovation, but I'm focused right in on the county level. And so I was pleased that to hear much of what he was saying was reinforcing what we were learning and have been learning for quite some time at the county level. Let's start off with what is it that counties do. Counties traditionally have been the service delivery arm for the state government. About 85% of what we do in Beltrami County originates from some kind of an order or directive or mandate from the state of Minnesota. And about 15% of what we do is something we get to do on our own. And so much of what we do and what we pride ourselves on is providing those services that are deemed most important by the state legislature and the agencies of the state of Minnesota. Through that process and our role in government, what we do and how we do it, our personality, is somewhat reflective of what we've been asked to do. Our personality is such that we focus in on services and programs. That's what we do. The sad part and the sad thing to admit is that oftentimes we don't think a great deal about those services and programs and whether they actually produce results. Instead, we are just looking to be compliant with the next audit from a state agency or to make sure we're compliant with those rules that are coming down. And historically, we haven't been all that attentive to whether what we do produces any actual outcomes or any actual results. In fact, largely what we do to measure our success is we measure our success based upon how much money we spend and how many people we attract to our programs, because that's what the agencies who oversee us pay attention to. And through that process, then, that there's definitely incentive on our part as county government to grow our services and programs. In theory, the more people we have participating in our programs and in our services, the more money we should be entitled to in order to provide even more or expanded services. And so what happens then, and what has historically taken place over the last, well, forever, it seems like, is that the dialogue between county government and state government is over mandates. It's over what is being obligated for us to do and who's going to pay for it. I would argue that for that generation that I've been involved so far in government, about 22 years, we've been arguing over the wrong thing. We should probably be arguing over what mandates don't work. Our orientation has been on programs and delivery of programs, but it has not been an orientation towards results or outcomes. Somewhere along the line, we have to find a way to change that dialogue, that the dialogue should be about what mandates actually work and are aligned with the expectations of the citizens that we serve, the priorities of those citizens on outcomes. One of the things that we have discovered in Beltrami County, I guess if there's a bottomless bucket of money, we can keep doing things the way we've been doing them, which is basically what I call a service delivery management orientation at the county level. Everything we do is intended to manage a service or program. And as long as you give us plenty of money, I am confident counties will manage those services and programs exactly the way you want them and the way you've laid them out. The challenge seems to be, though, that things are changing. What's happening around us is, of course, the economic climate is changing, demographics are changing. I would argue that citizens' expectations of us are changing, and that, quite frankly, county government needs to change too. And the change that I'm proposing and that we've been working on so hard is a change that moves us from a service delivery management orientation to an outcome-based management orientation. About 4 years ago, almost exactly 4 years ago now, we had a planning session with our county board and all of our county leadership. We took a whole day. We had staff with us. We challenged ourselves, look out into the future. Where do you see Beltrami County? We forced ourselves to confront the fact that Beltrami County has one of the lowest property tax capacities in the state of Minnesota. We also have about the highest tax effort of any county in the state of Minnesota. And we have among the highest poverty rates in the state of Minnesota. The reality that we were looking at as we worked through these things, also that really was hard for us to admit, but was true. If we looked at the services that we were providing, we really didn't know if we were doing a good job or not. We knew whether we were compliant with the rules or not, but we didn't really know if we were making a difference in the lives of the citizens of Beltrami County. What we had to confront in that meeting was a very basic question: is the way that we do business sustainable? And we concluded it wasn't. And so 4 years ago, we embarked on a plan to reinvent ourselves around outcome-based principles. Now, in your handout, there's a summary of some of the review and research that we did on current management theories. Whatever you want to call it, performance-based management, outcome-based management, results-oriented government, we call it strategy-aligned management. There are some basic principles that have come from the private sector and are now being applied into the public sector. And the first principle of all that literature is you better put the needs and desires and goals of the citizens first. I'm embarrassed to say that I have, or used to have, 400 employees in Beltrami County, and many of them really thought that their customer was someone who works in a cubicle in St. Paul. They had really, through this service delivery management orientation that we've drummed into them for these years of providing programs, they really deeply believed that the people they needed to satisfy was another government entity in another place, not their neighbors, not their family members who live in the community, not the businesses in town, not any of those constituents. They were accountable to a rule-making body and to those who enforced those rules. A second principle in common to all of the new literature in outcome-based government is that you need to know what your targets really are. What is it that you're hoping to accomplish? What is the outcome that you're pursuing? And quantify it. Third principle is develop a set of of leading and lagging indicators, performance measures, that tell you whether you're moving towards your target or not. I know these sound like real common sense things, but they really are innovative in a government setting. leading and lagging indicators, performance measures ought to be those things that keep a guy like me awake at night wondering if we're moving towards where we're supposed to be going. A fourth principle of outcome-based government is really a willingness to embrace new ideas and innovation, a willingness to move away from the status quo and consider new ideas and approaches to move those indicator needles, those things that we're charting to see if we're making progress. And the fifth principle, it's common in all this literature, is that you need to be held accountable. Not held accountable for services or programs, but be held accountable for actual results. Let me give you an example of this. This is an example that we use a lot in what we're doing in Beltrami County because it's easy for people to attach to. We have a mandate at the county level that we provide chemical dependency treatment services. Usually those services are ordered by the courts. Sometimes it's inpatient, sometimes it's outpatient services. We have a cost share requirement at the county level, a maintenance of effort that we are tasked to follow. And we spend about, a little over $1 million a year of state and Beltrami County taxpayer dollars meeting that mandate. When we started looking at some of the things that we were doing and trying to determine whether we're doing a good job or not, it is clear to me that we were satisfying all the state requirements for that program. We were doing a good job. I had employees that were patting themselves on the back. But when I asked them the question, how many people that we send to treatment actually complete treatment, they don't know. How many people after they go through treatment stay sober or clean for 6 months, they don't know. I think that's wrong. How the outcome-based process changes that dialogue, using this example and using those five principles of outcome-based government, is you start from a place of trying to understand what is it that the citizens value the most about chemical dependency treatment. The citizens don't value treatment services and programs. The citizens value when people get clean. And so if you want to quantify that, you certainly can. What does it mean for that to be a target? What are the performance indicators, the things that keep you awake at night to know if you're moving closer to that target? Well, we could talk about things like how many people actually complete treatment. That could be a measure that we could track. We could measure how many of those people participate in aftercare programs. We can measure how many people are staying clean or reporting clean after a year. There's lots of key leading and lagging indicators in this area that we can identify, we can track, but we just haven't in the past. Now, if I'm hiring nonprofits to provide these chemical dependency treatment services, and I know my target, and I know the leading and lagging indicators that I'm going to be tracking real close, religiously, then those nonprofits are going to have to look at how they provide the services to make sure they're providing the outcomes that I need. They're going to change their programs. They won't change them unless we demand it, but they will change those programs. And for our area, they need to change them in ways that are more culturally appropriate. Area, they need to find ways to include families and supports in different ways in chemical dependency activities. And they certainly have to figure out ways for aftercare, after treatment connections. Finally, how do you become accountable for that? We have found that the best way for us to be accountable, particularly in this kind of an example, is outcome-based contracting. In other words, we no longer purchase a service and have purchase of service agreements. We want to purchase results, and that's outcome-based contracting. And once you get past the initial hurdles with our partners about what that means, they begin to get excited about it because they don't know their, they know their programs aren't working either. And so now that they're getting that nudge to change, then they're starting to get excited and new ideas and innovation is starting to crop up in those areas. Change the dialogue, change the management orientation, and you change results. It seems like a very simple, commonsensical thing, but the reality is it's very hard. There's nothing easy about it at all. We have worked very hard for a long, long time to learn and to get good at service delivery approaches. To reinvent ourselves under an outcome approach requires a great deal of effort. One of the things that it requires us to do is to is to look in a more long-term strategic way. Lots of times as a county government, we're budgeting from year to year. We want to balance the budget from year to year. We want to run the program 1 year at a time. We want to enter into service delivery contracts 1 year at a time. If you're going to pursue outcomes, you have to be willing to expand the strategic focus you have over a longer period of time and be committed to the learning that comes through that period of time. The other challenge of this kind of a change is that you've got to, let me describe this hopefully in a way you will understand. Taking on the status quo is not for the timid. Okay, and so when you're trying to change, years and years and years of we've always done it this way, you have to be persistent, you have to be bold, you have to be willing to break a few eggs along that process. Because when you start asking those questions, why, what are we getting out of it, what's the results, what's the return on investment, which people don't like to have us say at the county level, then all of a sudden people get nervous, they defend the status quo, but you've got to get away, you've got to push through that in order for that to happen. I can give you lots of examples. I hope that our time will permit that I can share a few more specific examples of how we get challenged as we start making some of these changes. But one of the things that we need, I've come to you, I have a couple of asks. Some of those are in your handout. One of the asks is that if we're going to truly pursue an outcome-based orientation, and I really think that that's where we're going in county government, and I hope that's the way the state government will be going, there needs to be more of a dialogue of equals about those who participate in the setting and the implementation of public policy. See, under a service delivery management approach, what happens is you have overseers and you have others, you have subordinates. One way of describing it is you have state-supervised, county-administered programs. It doesn't become a dialogue where we each value the roles that we bring to that process of determining what the citizens value the most, what those targets should be, what the outcome measures should be that we're worrying about at night, how we find innovation, and how we hold ourselves accountable for real results. Another ask that I have is that we need help with the entrenched bureaucracies. I don't intend to be offensive, but I have learned in almost 10 years of working with Minnesota state government that the real power of state government rests at the agency level. These are individuals we rarely, as county officials, have any real concerns with statutes that are adopted, because when you talk about outcomes, you're talking about shared values, and these are values that Minnesotans share. But when it gets to the agency level, the agency rules are written in such a way that they are to enforce compliance with delivery of services and programs. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, those rules are not written to produce outcomes in many cases. And so if we are going to, as counties, continue to pursue those outcomes that we get really excited about, we need to have many of those rules rethought, reinvented, and written and composed in a way that they're oriented not towards services, but oriented towards outcomes. This is a different way of thinking. It's a different dialogue. It's a different way of serving our citizens. I can tell you I've made many, many, many presentations to Beltrami County citizens and other counties who are willing to listen to this maverick who's been doing this for 4 years. When you talk about outcomes and you talk about this change in management philosophy and orientation, citizens get excited. When you talk about this with your employees, they get excited. They feel like they've had handcuffs on themselves for so long, and the idea of taking the handcuffs off and focusing on real outcomes gets them jazzed. Okay. When you talk to the state agencies, they get really nervous. Okay. We have really good, talented, bright, capable people in these agency positions, but they have tied themselves up in those knots in many cases, and they do not feel safe moving away from the enforcement and the service delivery oversight orientation that they have had for so long. If we can unleash the creative juices of county employees and really state employees around outcomes, we can really do some things that are pretty impressive. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just tell you that this approach works. Again, we've been doing it for 4 years. It took us 2 years to figure out what it meant. It took us another year to really get some things in place. This year, we adopted our first county outcome-based budget. But I can tell you that in the last 2 years, Beltrami County has not increased the property taxes of our citizens. We've reduced our property taxes 2 years in a row. And I will also tell you, and I do this with some reluctance, because I never know how this will be used against me in the future, but we have returned from our annual budgeting process at the end of the year in Beltrami County in 2009. We returned $4 million to our budget reserves. 2010, we returned $6 million to our budget reserve, $10 million over 2 years. And largely because, not that we're over budgeting, and certainly not because we're collecting too much in revenue, but because as you get into this and you change the dialogue, you start seeing things different and savings start to come. There are, I know you want to find efficiency in government. I can tell you, my final comment, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is that another way of getting at efficiency is looking at effectiveness. And when we talk about outcomes, we're talking about how effective we are. And we get more effective, you'll find the efficiencies. That's been our experience. Thank you for giving me this unique, and I appreciate this opportunity to share our perspectives with you and our experience.
Mr. Murphy, it is truly refreshing to hear your successes to date. You've done something very good for the citizens of Beltrami County, and I applaud you for that. And I thank you for the time that you give talking and telling the story of Beltrami County, because it is truly where I believe that all of our counties as well as our state government needs to move towards. And you've started that process, as hard as it may have been to get to where you are at this point. Keep it up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson. And I do have to say this, okay. Now, believe me, I got new glasses this weekend, and I still couldn't see their names on the last three. It's something to do with the light, and it was twisted. Not that I needed to see them, but I thought maybe folks sitting at the testifying table couldn't see them. So, Lucas, you're off the hook on that one. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Tony, and Mr. Murphy, for bringing this to our attention. One of the questions that occurred to me as you're going through is, how did you achieve those economies of scale or those efficiencies, and what effect did it have on your workforce?
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, members of the committee, I, like most Minnesota counties right now, we've been reducing our workforce. We've reduced our workforce by 50 full-time equivalents over the last 3 years, almost 4 years, and that's about 13% of our workforce so far. We are a much more effective and efficient organization today than we were when we had those 50 employees before. One of the the employees who are getting involved in this, they're getting jazzed. Our best ideas are not coming from my office. Our best ideas are coming from those who are really on the front lines of this battle. But one of the things, just to explain again some of the challenges that you run into when you do some of this stuff, we've reduced our workforce by 50 FTEs. We're a better organization because of it. But now we're filling out our end-of-the-year pay equity report. We haven't laid anybody off. Our change has all come through attrition. But now we've done our pay equity report, we realize we're not in compliance with pay equity. So we call the state and we say, what do? We haven't made any changes. We just have had reductions through attrition. They said, you have two choices. You can pay your people more, or you can hire more people back into those areas where maybe you've lost some positions, but you've got to be in compliance with pay equity, or we're going to withhold state funds. They get a hammer out at that point. Now, here's how the outcome-based approach looks different. We all can agree in the value of pay equity. We support it 100%. But the problem is sometimes that gets into rules, and then it gets into a computer program, and then it gets into service delivery, orientation, and oversight, and you lose track, and you lose the ability to accomplish the outcome. Those are the kinds of rules that drive us nuts as we start moving forward with some of this stuff.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Murphy, thank you very much for your testimony. Very, very interesting conversation. In business, we talk about how to be innovative and how to change things, and we have a number of models for achieving that. Many would do it incrementally, try it, fix it, try it, fix it, try it, fix it. Some are more bold, and they would say that if it ain't broke, don't mess with it. Others say if it isn't broke, break it and fix it correctly. So as we're going through this process, how would you advise us to help you with the agencies, with the rulemaking? What are some methods that we could use going forward to implement some of the outcome-based conversations that you are having, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Senator, members of the committee, I mentioned earlier that our dialogue on mandates, I think, needs to change. And I think that the mandate discussion that we have isn't the question of continuing to argue and debate over who pays for the mandates. The debate should be over whether the mandates are working. The problem that I have every day, is that we're being held to the standards of rules that really can't necessarily be defended because they're written just to provide a program. And the outcome expectations aren't there. I'll give you an idea that will, if you want innovation, I'll give you an idea that will just blow it all up. I tend to be the kind that want to just blow it up and start over again when it's broke. But I really believe that many of the agency rules that that is tying our hands towards outcomes are written from a service delivery orientation. Sunset the rules and say we've got to go back and rewrite the rules, at least those that are continuing to be defended, from an outcome-based perspective, using outcome-based principles to reach commonly shared outcomes and goals and objectives that our citizens value the most. One of the reasons why I say that, Senator and members of the committee, is that I've been doing this for a long time and trying to prioritize limited resources on the basis of which program is more important or which service is more important is nearly impossible. But trying to prioritize outcomes, those outcomes and values that citizens rank as their highest, can be done. I think that a dialogue and a common process, a shared process, that looks at those rules and rewrites those rules for outcome basis would change government not just today, but forever in a positive way. And I would encourage, I watch the campaigns like everybody else. I'm nonpartisan, which is great. But I kept hearing people, the media ask you questions. If you're elected, what programs are you going to get rid of? You got this state budget problem. What programs are you going to get rid of? What programs are you going to cut? What services are you going to cut? Wrong question. The dialogue should be about what are the values for outcomes that our citizens value the most, and how are you going to prioritize those and reach those first? At least that's the way I see it, and that's the way we're approaching it in Beltrami County.
Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Murphy, a couple questions. First of all, you're the county executive, is that right?
Yes, the county administrator.
Have you had support from the county board then to implement some of this?
Had wonderful Murphy. Support from our county board.
And
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Murphy, if I might, maybe Mr. Chairman, more of a comment, but Mr. Murphy, it sounds like you've done a great job in Beltrami. But in part of your presentation, it sounds like maybe you invented the electric light or something. I just want to point out to the committee, and maybe, Mr. Chairman, this can be my role this year's session, is to talk about the good old days. But we've done that in the context of state government. When Governor Carlson was governor, there was implemented exactly this throughout state government. When I was chairman of the predecessor division, State Departments, which was, I think, about 2.5 times the size of what this division is, we participated in that as the other division chairs. Somewhere in this building, there are books this high with what Governor Carlson tried to implement. And at some point, the Carlson administration kind of lost interest. Something else we did in this division, again, in the good old days, is I utilized zero-based budgeting for all the large agencies. Now, I couldn't get anybody else interested at that time, so that kind of fell by the wayside. The problem we have in state government with these kinds of efforts, it's not that we can't do it, but we don't have a state executive. We have the elected executive, but we don't have, say, an administrative executive. The commissioner of administration has no role greater than, say, the commissioner of human services. So it takes a governor to get behind something like this, and that hasn't been the case for X number of years. Governor Carlson did it at the outset. Governor Ventura didn't have much interest. Governor Pawlenty comes in and is faced with crisis after crisis and had an inability, I would suggest, to do some of this simply because he had to fight, again, crisis after crisis. So it's not like this hasn't been done before. It has been, and most effectively by Governor Carlson in his first term. But again, one of the useful things about going into the minority is I had to go through my office across my former office across the hall, currently held by Senator Sendrum, and I had a chance to go through everything and see what I was going to keep and what I wasn't going to keep, because Senator Olson, did you do some of the same coming over? Because obviously I didn't have room for quite everything. It's kind of like, you know, downsizing your house. And I was actually looking for some of those, given the fiscal environment. And I don't know, Mr. Lundin, if the Carlson study books are available somewhere downstairs, are they?
The Legislative Reference Library has them all scanned online.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman, I would suggest.
I still have them.
Do you have them, Senator Olson?
I think I do.
Okay, so I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, before we fall over ourselves talking about what we should have been doing these last number of years, we have been doing it. And let's revisit some of this, see if in the context of our budget deficit, if we can implement what's already been done. So I just want to make that clear that some of this has been attempted, and I think what it's going to take to really implement it, though, and the problem with the legislature suggesting it is we got 201 of us, we all have election certificates, they're all the same size, and it becomes difficult to move a legislative body unlike, say, a 7-person, 9-person, 5-person county board. It's much different. And I know Governor Dayton has talked at length about his desire to try to do some of this. Tough for a chief executive to do it. He faces a significant crisis, as did Governor Pawlenty. But maybe if we could go to the Legislative Reference Library, or I'll take a second look through my stacks of stuff, or Mr. Lundin, maybe you could help take a look for some of this, we'd find that we've done it.
Thank you, Senator Cohen, and I would like to mention at this time, they were called the core reports, of which I do have your copy, Senator Olson, because you gave me that. I have read the core reports of 91, 92, 93. And what's amazing to me is that we didn't carry through on the recommendations. Matter of fact, I believe Governor Carlson was highly critical of the recommendations as I research and read through. However, what I'm going to do for all of you, I'm going to have staff pull them up, and I'm going to shoot you an email with those, because when you look at the core reports and compare them to the Commission on Service Innovation that Mr. Khanna was part of, that he spoke of, there are a lot of the same recommendations, just 20 years apart or so, and that's why I'm concerned that we find a way to move forward these recommendations and truly try to change how we show outcomes. Senator Ortman, then Goodwin, and then Thompson. Senator Ortman first. Go ahead, Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to say that I was trying to count back how many years ago Governor Carlson was our governor, and 20 years is a long time. We didn't have the internet then, and so I think it's ironic, Mr. Lundin's comments that the reports are now scanned and online, and that you're going to send us an email, Mr. Chair, about making them available, because we're talking about an entirely different time, maybe the same recommendations, but times really have changed. And it's not just that we now are in the internet age. We do have more access on the part of our residents, but more information makes them more informed residents. And I think now we have a political will that we've never had before. I look around this room, I look around the Senate and the House with the new elections and the new expectations on the part of the residents, and I think things have changed. I think this is the time that we can really take some of these recommendations forward. I don't know what Governor Carlson came up with, but sounds like it must be pretty good. If it follows what Mr. Khanna and Mr. Murphy have in mind here, I think we're ready. I think that's why we're on this committee. We're ready to help.
Senator,
which one? You said Thompson first.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Murphy, appreciated your presentation. You're very polite. If only I had your flair for tact. But you indicated early on that 85% of what you do is dictated by the state, and I would imagine that a fair amount of that is funded by the state. You then went on in a little bit later to talk about the fact that many of the people working in your county tend to view us as the client instead of the recipient of the service or the good in Beltrami County. I would submit to you that's rational on their part. So, again, you weren't willing to say it this way, but isn't the real problem that we try to force you to do too much? And maybe if that number came down and we allowed people like you to run your county instead of trying to run it from up here, it would be a lot easier to do those innovations on a much broader scale where you are. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chair and Senator, members of the committee, I've frequently been, you don't know me very well, I don't have great tact. I'm on my best behavior today. I'm doing good so far. But, you know, I often get asked by our citizens, how big is your budget? Well, you know, $57 million. And I keep thinking to myself, there ought to be a way for us to identify what outcomes are most valued by our citizens and meet those outcomes for $57 million. Much of what we've learned about our efforts so far, it isn't about money, it's about vision. It's about trying to really articulate better what it is that we're all about. We get involved in this as county officials, as local government officials and employees, to make a difference in people's lives. And we want to make that difference. And we need to find a way to shift the dialogue and to change the relationship a little bit so that we all understand who really is the customer. And it is the citizens of the state, in your case, citizens of our county, in our case. And it really ought not to be someone in a cubicle. And to the extent we can change that relationship, we will make significant changes in government.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Murphy, I'm interested to know a little bit more about your contracting, your vendors and your nonprofits. And I'm wondering if you make sure that when you enter into a contract that too is outcome-based, and that then I guess the second question would be, if it is outcome-based, then what do you do with vendors that don't meet your requirements, especially in a county that perhaps doesn't have a lot of choice of vendors, as we might hear in the Twin Cities? My concern is, and I like what you had to say about the taxpayer being the customer, because the Department of Administration here, which oversees all the procurement, about 4 years ago started, or 5 years ago started calling it the vendors, its customers, and I thought that was exactly the opposite of what should happen. But I am interested in how you get outcome information into your contract, if you do get it into your contracts, and if you do and they don't comply, what's the process?
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Senator, members of the committee, we're still a little new in this, some of that outcome-based contracting. We don't have a lot of vendor options sometimes, nonprofit partners, and they are our partners. But what we're learning to do is to sit down with those service providers and have a dialogue of equals. How do we put the citizens' needs first? What are the values? What should be the targets? What should be the key performance measures that we're going to agree to track? And what we are trying to do in our outcome-based contracting is not to make it punitive as much as it is to make it a learning experience. Let's go into this together with our partners and learn what works and learn what doesn't work and have a mutual commitment to each other that we're going to stop doing the things that don't work. And we're going to find ways to invest more into those things that do work. And as we've had that dialogue with our partners, we're stepping into it slowly and gradually, as I think is appropriate. But we're having great conversations from those people who are actually doing that work. And it's been well received.
We have time for one more. So We have two. Senator Dibble, and then we'll end up with Senator Olson.
Depends on how fast the answer is, I guess. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at the citizen perception survey piece, and I'm just curious if you could just share a little bit more around that activity. Sounds similar to something that the City of Minneapolis does to really solicit from the citizens their priorities and things they're focused on. They've been through a fairly extensive process of establishing service priorities and measurables, and then they report on those back to the citizens. I'm happy to share those documents with you, Mr. Chair, if the committee's interested. It might be a surprise. I think there's a lot of misperception about City of Minneapolis and its government, but it's fairly innovative around this area. So it has that accountability piece as well. It's reporting back to the citizens how well it's doing, good and bad. You know, see the example of the recent snow plowing, for example. But we've got great results with respect to crime and some specific activities that they've undertaken that I think have had some positive consequence. So how has that piece been rolled out, and how well is that functioning in Beltrami County?
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Senator, members of the committee, for the first time since I've been able to determine in our county, we are doing a statistically valid citizens survey. It isn't necessarily to ask citizens to rate our performance in services and programs. It has specifically been drafted, hopefully, for us to be able to identify those things that the citizens are valuing the most and to give us feedback on how we're doing. We don't have, for example, a list of ratings, how well do we provide the MFIT program, or how well do we do welfare to work, or how well are we doing on childhood immunization, or we don't list all of our programs that we do. Instead, we have broader topics, broader subjects, broader outcomes, and we're asking them to rate how we're doing. And we intend to report back to the county board, to the board, and to the citizens every year and be held accountable for those indicators to get better. We're using our survey as a secondary measure on how well we're doing in our performance. Not as a primary indicator, but as a secondary indicator that supports some of the other leading and lagging indicators that we've established.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate stories. You know, we've talked about principles, but when you gave an example, it really triggered in my memory a statement that was made when I was meeting with the group. When you were talking about the drug treatment, I remember being with a group of people outside of government that were asked just to give us input on things that were of concern to them. And this gentleman who'd been sitting there quietly opened his mouth and vehemently said, "Stop spending money on drug treatment programs that don't work." And, you know, that's never left me, but, you know, where do you start? You know, if we were to come in here and say we're going to cut the money out of drug treatment, you know, that goes counterintuitive that people need help and they want the results. One of the things that my mind, as I was listening to you, I think we also need some help, is if you were even just to take a small piece like that, where do you start? Can you start with a piece, or do you have to start with a big structure in order to get at moving to the results that you're looking for, and then seeing what is it that's in the way and kind of sorting that through? Can you reflect a little bit more on that? Because I'm thinking in education, we're dealing with some of the same big challenges, and we know what we're investing in now. How do you kind of turn that around so that we really are getting the results instead of having more money being spent and flatlining results?
Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Senator, members of the committee, I know you're running short on time, so I'll be real brief. I'm going to hearken back to the presentation that was before me, where they talked about how in state government we have massive amounts of data. Okay, the data is no good for measuring results and outcome. The data is being generated to determine whether we're providing programs and services, but not whether the programs and services are delivering results. And so if you're going to start making those changes, there has to be a commitment at some point to generate not just data for the sake of data and compliance, but data for the sake of determining whether we are accomplishing what we set out to do. And that is something that we do not do well at this time. But in our county, we're trying to change some of that. We have such antiquated systems. I'll just use a quick example, the Maxis system that's used in social services. We hate it. It generates massive amounts of data that, again, those who are in oversight capacities, works for them. It doesn't work for us in delivering services. my human services director told me last week that in a comparable study that she was looking at, the state of Ohio is, we're 30% as effective in our time of our staff working with clients than the state of Ohio is, 30% of them. And the big piece is how much time we have to use using a DOS-based software system. There's no incentive for the state to change it because it meets their needs in oversight. It's awful for providing the services and getting us quality data that we can use to deliver results. But you got to have data. You got to have good outcome data, not input data.
Mr. Murphy, thank you. And I'm sure if anyone has any questions, Mr. Murphy will hang around for a while. And you know, I would like to take you to have you take back to your county board. I know Commissioner Joe is here, but tell them, you know, I am truly impressed with them giving you the leeway